This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. The HBO series The Wire is about to step back into the spotlight again. The fourth season of the superb drama series will be released on DVD next week. And next month, the concluding fifth season will begin on HBO. Today on Fresh Air, we'll hear from Ed Burns, a writer and producer on The Wire. I love The Wire, and so does Terry, who spoke with Ed Burns last year. Here's what Jacob Weisberg wrote in Slate magazine. Quote, "The Wire is surely the best TV show ever broadcast in America. No other program has ever done anything remotely like what this one does, namely to portray the social, political, and economic life of an American city with the scope, observational precision, and moral vision of great literature." Unquote. The series is set in Baltimore's inner city and City Hall and follows several groups of people. The drug lords, the kids they use to sell drugs on the street corners, the cops who patrol the streets, the detectives who try to penetrate the drug trade through wiretaps, and the city's politicians. The season about to come out on DVD deals with an inner-city junior high where a former cop has become a teacher. Many of the stories in The Wire are based on the experiences of today's guest, Ed Burns. He served with the Baltimore City Police Department Drug Control Unit and specialized in homicide investigations and working on inner-city drug gangs. He retired after 20 years on the force, then taught in Baltimore middle and high schools for 7 years. Terry spoke with Ed Burns last year.
Ed Burns, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, I know you've been a cop and a teacher. Did you feel more vulnerable as a teacher than you did as a cop?
I felt at a total loss as a teacher, and that's because I never taught. I was in the classroom, but teaching is not what you do when you're teaching in the inner city until you get to a school where it's possible. And I did manage finally to get to a school where it's possible, but it's the most powerful experience of my life.
Why is that? I mean, you'd been on the streets, you'd been dealing with drug dealers and homicide. Why was being in an inner city school more powerful than that?
Because when you're on the street, you see adults and you see where they're coming from and how they're acting, and you can sort of understand it. But when you see the same mindset in kids, and there's no way you can reach past what that mindset is, then the tragedy is that much greater, because you're looking down the future. You're looking where they're going to go. In the first year that I taught at Hamilton Middle School, we had a group of 220 kids in the seventh grade, and 13 had been shot, two of them twice. It's that kind of despair that it's sort of there for you. It doesn't cripple you in any way. You know, in fact, you can use it as an energy, but it's still there.
And in school, you know, in this junior high school, I'm sure you had a lot of kids who were acting up a lot in class, and you know, maybe even violent in class. On the street, you can arrest somebody. You can threaten them with arrest. In school, what do you have? I'm going to send you down to the principal's office?
Well, that's the normal thing, is you can send them to the principal's office. The other way of doing it is to try to put the onus on the kid. And I look at teaching sort of as a boxing match. You get in the ring, and when the bell rings, you throw the first punch. So you have to get them off balance, and you keep punching, because if you stop punching, then they'll counterpunch. So you got to keep them off balance. You got to keep moving. You got to keep challenging them, and you got to show them who you are, because these kids will respect you for who you are. They don't respect the institution so much, but they will respect you as an individual. So once they sort of know who you are, then the violence doesn't really happen that much in your classroom. It'll happen in the halls. It'll happen in other people's classrooms. But they'll give you a break, I guess, because they see you trying.
Now, there's an incredible scene this season in The Wire in Presbuleski's class where, like, one of the girls who's been teased by another girl gets, like, so angry and out of control that she takes a razor blade and slashes that girl across each side of her face. And then the girl who's been attacked is just kind of lying there and, you know, blood going all over. It's a horrifying scene. Is that scene based on something that actually happened in one of your classes?
It didn't happen in my class. It happened in the cafeteria at the school. And it happened after the two girls had fought, and both girls had been suspended for short periods of time. So it took about almost a week and a half before the second eruption occurred. And it was mayhem, as you can imagine, just like in the scene that we portray. And you don't know when these things are going to happen, and you don't really know why. They just suddenly erupt, and it seems spontaneous. But actually, it's very, very premeditated because of each of these kids has a street persona. It's the only thing they have in their life. It's the shards of their individuality. They keep this close to themselves, and they know an infraction. They sense an infraction immediately, and they've trained themselves to react. And the reaction can come instantaneously or a month later, but it will come. And that's the thing that sort of gives it the appearance of being spontaneous, but it's not. It's very, very practiced, at least in their heads, what they're going to do.
I want to play the scene in which the students first ask Prez, the teacher, if he was a cop before he became a teacher, because they've heard that he'd been a cop, and they want to find out for sure. And this is a day shortly after that razor fight in the classroom, and Prez is determined. He figures his kids are traumatized by it, and he wants to talk to the students about what happened, just like kind of talk it through with them. So here's a scene where he's trying to talk with them about the razor flight, and they want to know if he'd been a cop.
Okay, listen up. I'd like to, everybody, I'd like to talk. Listen up! Now, we all know something unpleasant happened here Friday. And look, I know some of you are still trying to get your heads around.
Hey, my head got a big old gash.
And I'd like to discuss.
Yo, is it true that you police?
What?
Miss Carmen, you up in the office? Say, Mr. Presbo, he police.
Yo, you police, man?
You ever shoot somebody?
I think we should talk about.
He shot no one. Look at him. Yo. You ever bust a man named Asante Grant?
Sometimes when something bad happens.
That's your dad?
Nah, I'm brother.
Why can't you tell us if you shot somebody or not?
What kind of gun you carry?
You knocker?
I used to be police. Now I'm a teacher. But being a police isn't just about carrying a gun.
Yeah, right.
It's about working with the community.
The community? Y'all ain't been up in my community in a long time except the well on people.
Yo, Mr. P, you ever been shot? I mean, like,
name it. That's enough.
That's a scene from The Wire on HBO, and my guest Ed Burns is a writer and producer of the series. You know, by setting some of the story this season in a junior high, you get to see kids at that transitional stage where they can either get sucked in by selling drugs and gang warfare and the thug life, or they can maybe go in a healthier and safer, more productive direction. And you see that toughness taking hold of them, but you also see that vulnerability buried underneath their public face. Is that one of the reasons why you wanted to set part of The Wire in a junior high school this year?
It was. We wanted to show you where the Bodies and the Stringers came from. We picked middle school because it seems to be a time of vulnerability. And it's where you can still have some great actors who have range. In truth, middle school, the game has already been played. It goes way back to elementary school, where you really have options, if you have any options there at all. But by setting these kids up as being vulnerable, being childlike, you then buy into them, and you want the best for them. You want them to succeed.
But again, it gets to the difficulty of trying to reach somebody like that because there's so much toughness on the exterior. You have to really kind of go deep inside to find that vulnerability and to find the kind of like decent kid underneath all that.
You do. We all operate from like certitudes of knowledge. And the great certitude that comes with the corner life is the idea of you can't be chumped. You have to be tough. And all that certitude of being tough shapes who you are.
You know, in The Wire, the police commander played by Bob Wisdom finds the drug dealing situation so hopeless that he creates an alternate way of dealing with it. Every corner, it seems, in the neighborhood has, you know, drug dealers on it. And so what he does is move them off the corner into three free zones. And these are three areas that are like so bummed out and so abandoned that there's nobody really living there anymore, so there's nobody to disturb. So he creates these three free zones, rounds up all the dealers, and what does he tell them?
Well, he basically gives them a pass. He says, you move down here, and you can sell your drugs, and nobody will bother you. That was David Simon's idea. And I remember when we were right in the corner, we were walking up Vine Street in one of those days where everybody around us was high. And David said, you know, this is what we should do. We should, you know, do it like at Amsterdam. We should just move them all into one area and, you know, let them have it, you know. He then took that idea and nurtured it for years, and then it came out in this Hamsterdam of Bunny Colvin. The word Hamsterdam, I think George Pelicanus came up with that one. And
because it's like
was,
hamsters in a cage or like experimental
mice
or something?
Like, no, it's more as if when the cops were trying to explain it to the kids, Herc said to one of the kids, you know, you move down here, it'll be okay. It's like Amsterdam. And when the kid heard it, he heard Hamsterdam. And he said, I ain't going to damn Hamsterdam, you know. And so it became Hamsterdam. And that name sort of made it happen.
Okay, so there's a scene where the police commander learns that one of the reporters has gotten wind of what's happening in Hamsterdam. So he figures, like, he'd better tell his superiors before they find out in the paper. So he holds off the reporter for a little bit and does a slide presentation to the people he reports to in the city. And I want to play that scene in which he's doing the slide presentation to the chief of police and to other officials in the city.
North and Pulaski, the photo was taken at 4 p.m., prime time for street-level dealing. And that is Riggs and Calhoun, Mountain Fayette, Emerson and Bryce. That's your old foot post, Deputy.
I know where it is, Major. What I don't know and very much want to know is, where is the West Baltimore drug trade?
I hope, Major, these are not staged photographs you're showing us.
No, sir. They're not. No, Deputy. I found another approach.
I'm all ears, Bunny.
I moved them off the corners.
Damn it. Don't be coy with me, Major. I can see that. What I want to know is how the f*** you managed to move them and where the f*** they are now.
Deputy, I don't know quite how to put this, but I began by identifying those areas in my district where drug trafficking was least harmful and proceeded to push all street-level dealing towards those areas. Now, at first, dealing with the juveniles on them corners, I had a little success. But ultimately, by rounding up all the mid-level dealers in my district and making them offer they couldn't refuse, I was able
to... You made them an offer?
Yes, sir. Either they move their people to one of three designated areas where drug enforcement was not a district priority, or they face the wrath of every able-bodied soul in my district.
Major, I don't understand. The only time we can hold a drug corner is when we assign officers to stand there. Your slides don't suggest any concerted deployment on any corners. How were you able to
Jesus Christ, you nit. Don't you see what he's done? He's legalized drugs.
Ed Burns, what is your opinion of the commander's plan here to get the dealers off the neighborhood streets by moving them to three free zones?
What's my opinion as far as legalizing drugs? I'm in favor of that, or decriminalizing them. It was a real interesting process we had to go through as the writers to sort of to figure out how to make this happen, that it was credible, and how the information didn't get downtown quicker so that it would sort of follow all the other arcs in the story. It turned out great. And it made Bunny Colvin the reformer. That was the season of the reformers. He was playing opposite Stringer Bell, who was trying to reform the drug world. So you had the two reformers, and then everybody else was a pseudo-reformer. So Stringer had to die, because reformers die, and couldn't kill Bunny, so he was fired, which is another form of death. It was great.
What made you feel most hopeless as a cop using the tactics that you had at your disposal to fight the war on drugs?
I never felt hopeless. I really enjoyed what I was doing because I had a chance to find what I thought was the most dangerous group in the city and then work on them. So I was taking down guys that were doing all sorts of murders to further their drug activities. And where the frustration would come in was the fact that, there was no follow-up. So if you would go into an area, you would take down a guy who controlled, say, the towers in a housing project, and you would basically reduce the murder rate there to zero for maybe a year or so, but then it would pick back up. So there was no effort to try to stabilize the area once you've gotten one of these violent gangs out. These gangs are... they control big chunks of Baltimore and big chunks of northern Philly and, all over. And you have to go after these guys because they're the mayors. They're the lords. So it's fun to go after them in my world to bring them down, but the thing is it's like it's pulling dandelions. You pull up one and you turn around and there's another one.
Tell us about one of the big drug dealers that you brought down.
I would take the guy who was doing... it would always come out of a murder, mm-hmm. because murder is a good energy force to sort of get the bosses to at least look at, what you're trying to do. There was a bunch of guys. There's a guy named Warren Bordley who controlled Lexington Terrace. He was a young guy, probably had maybe a couple hundred people working for him. He was doing murder for hire plus the drug dealing. And we used an informant that we developed to bring him down. And we used that and a series of grand jury probes to finally bring him down. It took 2 years. It was a joint FBI city project, and it was one of the most difficult cases I ever worked on because of how smart Warren was and how tight he was into that neighborhood. He's sort of like the Marlowe character that we brought on in season 3.
Did you work in a wiretap unit?
We didn't have a wiretap unit. I created my own wiretaps.
How do you create your own wiretaps?
You begin by, as we explained in the first season, you begin by looking at your target and trying to get your target in legitimate ways, straight-up ways, the standard police ways. And when those all fail, then if you can show that they're using electronic means to interact, then the law allows you to go into and do that. And we pushed it to one in one case where we actually went from bugging a house to putting a camera in the house. And we watched this, this huge heroin cocaine distribution operation where they were just cutting the dope on the table and the camera was picking it all up. And, you would watch them cut all night long. And when they were finished, they would have two laundry baskets full of dope for the street. And you saw money coming in where they would wrap it up, into nice squares of about a foot by a foot. And when the guy Cookie was finished wrapping the squares, he just threw that lump of money over his shoulder and started again. And, you can do all this if you have, one, the okay from the department and the time. Then you can build these cases. You always find a prosecutor who wants to do it. The problem is the police department doesn't want to do it.
Why not?
Because that's not what they're into. They're into stats. If it took me 2 years to bring down, say, a Cookie or a Warren or a Rudy or these guys, that's one stat, one guy. You know, I could go up on the corner in one day and pick off five or six guys, no problem. There's no weighted point scale system in the game. Each guy is just a guy. So if you're trying to generate stats, then you're not going to do it well if you're just spending 2 years catching maybe 30 guys.
The Wire follows the drug gangs, the police who try to bring them down, the students and teachers at an inner-city middle school, and the city's politicians. Many of the stories in The Wire are based on Burns' experiences. He served on the Baltimore Police Department's Drug Control Unit, and after retiring from the force, taught in the public schools. Terry spoke with Ed Burns last year.
You have some fantastic writers on The Wire, and I'm thinking of Richard Price, who's probably most famous for the book and the movie Clockers, Dennis Lehane, who's most famous for the movie and the book that it's based on, Mystic River, George Pelicanos, who has several series of crime novels set in the Washington, D.C. area. What's your method of working with them? You've kind of co-written every story of this season, nearly every one of them. So what's your way of interacting with the writers? You have the experience on the street. They're the professional writers.
Well, we all get into a room. Dave Simon, George Pelicanos, myself, Bill Zorzi, a former political editor for the Sun Papers in Baltimore. And we just start working with the arc, the story, and shaping the story. And then when Richard comes down for his episode or Dennis comes down for his episode, they participate in that story creating process. But it's kind of tight because we know where the story's going, so you don't have a whole lot of latitude. But within that latitude, it's amazing what people like Dennis Lehane and Richard Price can come up with. I mean, Richard Price is so sharp, it's unbelievable. I mean, his mind just races. He's a one-man, comedy act. It's incredible how smart that guy is and what he knows. And the energy in that room just blossoms the story. And, it's not the nicest place to be because there's a lot of yelling and screaming because people were talking about different directions and stuff, but in the end, the product is what it is, and I think it stands up to the test of at least the critics.
I want you to elaborate on something that I read you say in an interview. In fact, I think this interview is on the HBO website. But you were saying that when casting for the teenagers who were playing the junior high school students in The Wire, that you didn't want the kids to have just kind of like studied like hip-hop, to just do like hip-hop gestures and hip-hop mannerisms. What were your concerns with this?
Well, what we were looking for was four real kids. The problem with hip-hop, it's so invasive, is that it shapes the way kids are acting today. And you have to look below that because on the corner, hip-hop is not where it's at. I mean, go on the corner, it's about everyday life. So you have to have something underneath that. And a lot of times when you were watching these kids, every move that they made was the same as the one before it and the same as the one after it. So you were looking for kids who you sensed had the ability to expand the range. And I think we looked at about 500 kids to narrow it down to the four that we've eventually used. And those guys, each one had an extraordinarily difficult task, and each one just did a magnificent job getting it done.
I think the spookiest character this season is a teenager nicknamed Snoop, who's basically a young teenage hitman. Or hit woman. I mean, when I saw this character, I kept thinking, is it a girl or is it a boy? It's a boy, definitely a boy. It turns out it's a girl. She has this way of speaking that is so kind of like both slangy and mumbly that it's almost hard to make out what it is she's saying, although you always get the gist of it because it's usually about killing somebody. Can you talk about the actress and how you found her?
The actress is Felicia Stokes, and Felicia was at a club with Michael K. Williams. Michael was there separate from Felicia.
He's one of the actors in the series.
He's the one who plays Omar. Phenomenal actor. And Felicia, Snoop came up to him and started rapping to him and then reached up and sort of grabbed him by his neck and pulled him down and says, you know, you ain't going to believe this, but I'm a girl. So, and Michael didn't believe it. Michael's eyes, you know, got real big. And he said, well, you got to be on the show. So he took her to Perry, our head of security, and Perry got in touch with me, and I came down, and I took a look at her, and she started talking, and I said, sure, let's give it a try, and went back, and David was all for it, and we wrote a part for her, and we slid her in as Chris's accomplice, and the first time she didn't show up, and which is fairly typical, because, you know, there's a lot of pressures on people, and, you know, acting is just a dream for a lot of them. But she called me up. She had gotten locked up in a stolen car in New York. She wasn't a driver. She didn't even know the car was stolen. And, you know, she begged for another chance. So we said, sure, come on down. Try again. And she did. And from that point on, she has been on the mark every episode, doing a phenomenal job. Just an incredible job. And she is the real thing. I mean, she is the quintessential street.
So does she speak that way, the way she does in the series, does she speak that way in real life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what she brings to your writing is that when she says it, you know, she'll change a word. You know, she's very nice. She'll come up and say, you know, we don't really say it that way. Well, how do you say it, Snoop? And then she'll say it, and you go, well, that's much better. You know, we'll go with that. She has that kind of knowledge, and she's fabulous. And the thing about her is that you can just see the projection. You know, even when she's just in a scene but not talking, she can radiate that character, and you can really feel it.
Well, I'd like to play a scene that she's in, and this is a great scene from the very beginning of this current season of The Wire. And she's in a hardware store, one of those big kind of stores. It's called Hardware Barn. And she's looking for a drill. And we find out later the reason why she needs the drill is because she's nailing shut dead bodies, the bodies of people that she's helped kill in abandoned houses. And she nails them shut with this drill. But so she's in the store looking for a drill. And the salesman comes up to her thinking that she's just, you know, another customer who's doing, you know, some kind of construction job, and here's the scene. And I should say, her language is not the kind of language you could get away with on radio. So you'll be hearing a lot of bleeps in this.
I see you got the DeWalt cordless, your nail gun, DeWalt 410.
Yeah, the trouble is you leave it in the trunk for a while. Need to step up and use the bitch. The battery don't hold up, you know.
Yeah, the cordless will do that. You might want to consider the powder-actuated tool. The Hilti DX460MX or the Simpson PTP, these two are my Cadillacs. Everything else on this board is second best, sorry to say. Are you contracting or just doing some work around the house?
No, we work all over.
Full time?
No, we had about 5 jobs last month.
At that rate, the cost of the powder-actuated guns justifies itself.
You say powder?
Powder.
Like gunpowder.
The DX460 is fully automatic with a 27 caliber charge. Wood, concrete, steel to steel, she'll throw a fastener into anything. And for my money, she handles recoil better than the Simpson or the P3500. Now, you understand what I mean by recoil?
Yeah, the kickback. I wish.
That's right.
27 caliber, huh?
Yeah, not large ballistically, but for driving nails, it's enough. Any more than that, you'd add to the recoil.
Man, I say no tiny 22 round nose, dropping plenty of days, man. Man, you like a pinball, whip your up. Big joints, though, big joints, man. Just break a bone, just say. I'm gonna go with this right here, man. How much I owe you?
It's $669 plus tax.
No, you just pay at the register.
No, man, you go ahead and handle that for me, man. And keep the rest for your time.
That's a scene from this season of the HBO series, The Wire. My guest, Ed Burns, is a writer and producer of the series. This is really a heck of a scene because, you know, as the hardware salesman realizes how really kind of crazy and dangerous this kid is, he just doesn't know what to do, and his whole expression changes, and he's completely disturbed by it, but feels, I think, kind of helpless in figuring out how he should respond. Was this scene, Ed Burns, based on anything that you'd witnessed?
No, this is we talked about this scene. David's the one who wrote it. And the beauty of it is you're looking at two people from, again, two different cultures.
Right.
You know, in a position where they've crossed the chasm. She's coming to this, you know, into our world. And the salesman is trying to, you know, give her every courtesy. And Snoop character is responding to it. She even gives him a bump at the end, an extra money. At the end of that, she goes back and hooks up with Chris, and in a very nice way.
Who's the senior hitman?
Who's the senior hitman? Who in a very nice way, she, you know, says to him, you know, he said Cadillac, but he meant Lexus, you know. So she was forgiving of him that this guy didn't really know that much about her world. She was able to understand that.
Yeah, because he describes this as the Cadillac of drills and should have
Cadillac
been the Lexus
of drills.
And,
you know, which he meant to say was the Lexus of drills, which is not only the character, but that's something that Felicia herself can do. And it's extraordinarily rare because she grew up in a very, very tough neighborhood in a very, very tough world and spent a lot of years in prison. She has this ability to step outside of herself and to be able to laugh at herself, to see who she is, and that is so rare in that world. It's just you don't find that many people. I might, in 20 years of being a cop, I might have met like 3 or 4 people who had that. Whatever it is, whatever genetic bit of information allows you to do that, she has it, and it's intact. And considering where she came from, it's just an amazing thing to see.
I want to ask you about another character on the series, and that's a snitch who's named Bubbles. And he's a guy who has a lot of street smarts and is very, very like verbally facile, but he's an addict and he's physically weak, so he's always getting beaten up by somebody. Did you create this character, and did you have any snitches yourself or anything like him?
I had tons of snitches, and he sort of crafted upon the guy who was really Bubbles, who died of AIDS back in the late 80s. And he was a guy who was, as you said, facile on the street and quick and stuff like that, but weak. And he would use the police to sort of right wrongs, you know, that he saw. And so that's who the Andre Royo character is based upon.
Explain what you mean by that, using the police to right wrongs.
Well, if you're getting, one of the things that Bubbles used to do is he used to be a rabber. He used to sell fruit off of a cart, you know, a horse-drawn cart through the neighborhoods when you could still get into the back alleys in Baltimore. And he used to keep his dope. He'd take a gourd and he'd hollow it out and he'd put his dope in the gourd. And he got bumped off by a couple of stick-up guys, you know. Well, he couldn't do it. He couldn't go back at these stick-up guys. He didn't have that kind of weight. So when I ran across him, we got to talking, and he said, I know two guys that carry guns. Well, that's a big deal. And, you know, he gave them up. I found them, locked them up. And then eventually he would tell me, you know, what the story really was, why he was willing to give these guys up. So Andre plays a great role with that. The real Bubbles, you couldn't understand. It took me almost a year to be able to understand how he spoke. He, especially when he got excited, he made no sense whatsoever. Andre is a lot clearer when it comes to speaking, anyway.
one other character on The Wire I have to ask you about, and that's Omar. And he's this guy, he's like a stick-up guy, but he holds up drug dealers. And he's gay. And he has this kind of like gold robe that he wears and would actually walk through the neighborhood in it. And very unique character. Is he based on anybody?
Well, one of the best sources of information a cop can have is a stick-up artist who's doing drug dealers. Because once you start sticking up drug dealers, you have to carry a gun because they're after you. So if you can catch up with them before the dealers do, then you can work out some kind of accommodation with this guy, you know, before the judge, and this guy can go to work for you. So I used to hunt down these guys quite a bit because they were always willing to talk. And so I knew a lot of them. And when David and I were creating the character, we wanted to make this character the one guy who stood up against the institutions, the one guy who was separate from the institutions. And as we crafted him, we decided that he would never cuss. And to make it that much more difficult for the audience to accept him, he would be gay. And Michael K. Williams has just done a phenomenal job with this character. I remember the first time that Michael stepped on a set. There was a small little scene where he was going to... with his running buddy, Brandon, they were going to go do a robbery. And the scene was that he was going to pop open a shotgun, put a couple shells in it, flip it locked, and Brandon was going to cuss, and Omar was going to put his finger on Brandon's lips and say something to the effect of, you know, such foul language shouldn't come across such beautiful lips. So in preparation for the scene, the prop master brought the shotgun, and I was standing right there. And he hands it to Michael and turns and walks away, basically. And Michael says, wait a second. How do you open this? And I'm thinking to myself, oh, my God, this guy doesn't know how to open a shotgun. What's going to happen? And, you know, the director said, let's go. So Michael stepped out there, and you would have thought that in his crib he had at least one shotgun, if not two. He handled it with just such knowledge. And just such a familiarity. And that's what this character can do. The actor is so good. And I don't know how he transforms himself, because Michael K. Williams is just one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And yet there's a veil that comes down over him that makes you feel that he is a stick-up artist. And of course, that was the scene where they kiss, which was not scripted either.
Were you surprised then?
I was surprised. It was great. It was a great moment, and we kept it in. But it was just those guys trying to do for the characters what they thought they should do.
So how has it changed your stature? You know, I mean, you've had three roles in the community, you know, detective, teacher, and now producer-writer for The Wire. So, you know, how has it changed the amount of respect you get to be one of the main guys behind The Wire?
Well, it gives you a certain credibility in places where I couldn't go before. One is, you know, I'm tighter now with the gangsters than I've ever been, as far as them being willing to talk to me. They even forgive me my being a cop at one time. And policymakers suddenly think that we're smart. You know, it's like, so people are starting to ask us, you know, like, what's the problem in Baltimore and things like that. And in that sense, it's good, because it gives us a chance to come from a point of view that most people don't come from, and to cause that frustration that might, you know, spur an idea that's not really on the horizon right now.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ed Burns, a writer and producer on the HBO drama series The Wire, speaking to Terry Gross in 2006. The fourth season of the show comes out next week on DVD. The fifth and final season, and I can't wait for this one, focuses on the media in Baltimore and gets inside the newspaper and TV newsrooms. It arrives in January.